Hello, this is Melissa, and it's the 14th of July, 2024, and it really is the wee hours. It's just after midnight, but I've been out in space and deep underground in my thinking all day long, and then we had that assassination attempt, and that was a distraction. So I'm just getting down to talking to you, and I thought I would share how I came to choose today's Redux. I had several interesting email exchanges this week, and one of them was a person who was investigating scalar technology. And they sent me an email, series of emails actually, with some videos to watch, and I did watch a couple of them. And they wrote, "I'm just beginning to appreciate the gravity of these revelations. I knew, thanks to Alan Watt, that Albert Einstein was a fraud. But now I understand not only the context, but also the motives of the masters in promoting him. Einstein posited that nothing was faster than the speed of light, and it's since been set in stone as an inarguable established law of physics. Neutrinos, which are used in CERN and as a clandestine military weapon, are faster than the speed of light. It was necessary to turn Einstein into the star and authority on physics in order to conceal hidden, suppressed high technology from the public." Now, Alan talked a lot over the years about the three levels of science, and he made it clear that in his research and thinking, that what we are given as the highest science and research is pretty low-level stuff. So I looked for talks, and there were quite a few where he went into a little bit, touched on scalar weaponry or that it was used. So he didn't really talk about how scalar technology works, but he would say that it was being used. One of the things that I did over the last couple of days was to try to understand scalar technology. And it is interesting. It's very interesting. When you type in scalar weaponry or scalar technology into a browser, you're going to come back with directed energy weapons. That's how it's phrased. Someone else sent me a reminiscence about a time they were near an island. I think it's off of Argentina, and I do believe that the Russians have a lot of activity going there, an island called La Orchila. And they witnessed the zigzagging or tic-tacking UFOs. And they moved incredibly fast. They commented that this was so fast that no human could have endured that kind of G-force. And it flew right over them and you know, it was just moving at an incredible speed. And when it was gone, then it came back. And they found the experience of witnessing this to be surreal. Others have cited the zigzagging or tic-tacking UFOs coming right out of the ocean in that area. And I remember Alan showed me several videos of Bill Cooper, where Bill Cooper had a team that went down and showed craft appearing to just come directly. I mean, they did come. They didn't appear to. They came directly out of the water. This was at a lake in Arizona. I believe it might have been New Mexico, but you can find that online. I've got it on DVD somewhere. And I, you know, anyway, if you search and scrounge around, you'll find Bill or William Cooper talking about these incredible craft. That one thing that he covered, it was just coming out of out of the side of a mountain, which happened to be mountain next to the lake. And the other one that they observed was coming directly out of the water. So very James Bond. The person that had actually witnessed the zigzagging sent me this story, and some of you might remember this. This was covered in the congressional hearings on UFOs in the last couple of years, but it was actually observed by Navy pilots in 2004. And this is from CBS News. The story behind the Tic Tac UFO sighting by Navy pilots in 2004. During a Wednesday hearing before House lawmakers on unidentified anomalous phenomena, also known as UFOs, a retired Navy fighter pilot testified about his experience seeing what he described as a tic-tac-looking object while on flight back in 2004. Retired Navy Commander David Fravor was commander of the FA-18F squadron on the USS Nimitz when he says he spotted the object during a flight off the coast of Southern California on November 14, 2004. He said to somebody that he was with, "Dude, do you see that thing right down there?" And we saw this little white tic-tac-looking object, and it's just kind of moving about the whitewater area. Advanced radar on a ship that was part of their training group, the USS Princeton, detected what the operators called multiple anomalous aerial vehicles over the horizon that descended 80,000 feet in less than a second. So I'll post up a couple of things and you can take a look at that. In my wanderings around this talk of Allen's, I was thinking about what we're supposed to believe about how far along we are. And the ideas or my own imaginings of where we might actually be. And at one point, a caller, actually there were two calls that were quite interesting here, but one of them was that a person called in and said that he had been abducted by aliens, he thought. And I think the way that Alan handled that, first of all, he chuckled, and the guy said, "No, I mean, this something happened." And Alan said, "Well, something happened, yes, but why do you assume that it was aliens?" And so he talked about the importance of planting that culturally, and how it was in multiple movies, a Betty and Barney Hill abduction, and then it was endless movies and books and till many people under hypnosis said, yes, that happened to them too. It always had, it was the Hollywood grays. And then he had another caller who read a bit from Alan's book to him and wanted to question him on that. And I'll let you listen to that, but I am going to repeat some elements of it because it might be worth hearing twice. The caller said on book two, this is of the Cutting Through books, page 60, it says, "No human, accent on human, high priest of the mysteries could create the great deception that fools the whole world." So that's what Alan wrote. "No human, high priest of the mysteries could create the great deception that fools the whole world." And the caller said, "That's pretty dramatic, right?" I thought, for me, that was a cliffhanger. And so I went into book three, and another quote from page 84, it says, "Countries fall one by one by subversion, by a determined group of men of secrecy, a special brotherhood with a cunning and total ruthless something at the top. Something almost incredible intellect and knowledge of human behavior, something which plans the future many centuries in advance. Then a little bit later, you say, this dark thing." And so that sounded almost like the devil or aliens, or I mean definitely inhuman, because you use that word a couple of pages later in describing that. And Alan said, "There's no doubt you're talking about something that is definitely inhumane. There's two categories. You've got human and humanness, and you have inhumanity." And the caller said, "Then they could just be a bunch of inbred psychopaths." And Alan said, yes, but there's no doubt they themselves do have a religion, and the religion encompasses things which are pretty well the opposite of what we think of as a normal, functioning, good, healthy society. Their ability to guide society into forms of hell on earth are very, very real, as they've done with world wars and all the other wars they've had before. They tell incredible lies to whole nations of people without blinking. And now psychopaths can certainly do that. But they also have a belief in themselves as a form of God. And then he hears the music coming in, and they'll come back. And when they do come back, essentially, Alan steered the answer that he gave, was steering it into eugenics, their own breeding program that makes them, you know, essentially very different than we are. And my first reaction to that was, oh, Alan, yeah, you know, why does he always so deftly avoid certain questions or certain lines of inquiry? Why not just say what you think this dark thing is? So there I was in my thinking, but I knew why. I knew why. It's like, did Alan talk about a woman who floated down the stairs whose eyes glowed red? Yes, he did. There were a few really out there experiences that he had, or observations that he had, and he didn't mind saying that. But he himself would say, just as he said to the caller about the UFOs, why make an assumption? Why make it a thing? And as I listened to it again and then reread it on the transcript, then I really got it. I had my aha moment. You see, because the caller said this a little bit later, you say this dark thing. And so that sounded almost like the devil or aliens, or I mean definitely inhuman, because you use that word a couple of pages later in describing that. And my aha moment with this was that because the caller said devil or aliens, Alan instantly knew where he was coming from and what his limitations of thought might be, and how he understood something based on the way that he had been programmed or indoctrinated or educated to understand it. And he had not had either the experiences or the thought processes that would allow him to see it differently. And Alan was not going to be backed into a corner and forced to give it the label that that person would understand. And so it's beautiful. I mean, that's Alan. Nobody like him. Beautiful. I was reminded of a word that I learned. Alan and I were either reading a Malachi Martin book, or we were listening to Malachi Martin talk about one of his books. It could have been his book called The Jesuits, or it might have been another one called Windswept House, which was a thinly fictionalized account of the Vatican and how the Vatican had basically been taken over to serve do the bidding of the New World Order. Of course, it's a total piece of fiction, right? But he used a word, accretion, and he went on to explain that when he was using that word, he meant the way that something builds on top of something until it actually becomes like part of it. And I think he might have even said like barnacles on a ship. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And the context was that the Catholic Church had accretions of dogma upon dogma and tradition and ritual that no longer meant anything. And he said, if you can't separate the essence from the accretions, then the essence itself loses itself to the accretions. And I could visualize that word. It made sense to me, and I really liked it. But it wasn't until some time later that I learned that the word accretion had other meanings. And in physics, it has an important process and an important meaning. And this is something from an article from astronomy.com. And the title is The Physics of Accretion, How the Universe Pulled Itself Together. To form a celestial object, start with a gas cloud and add gravity. Then it gets complicated. Accretion is one of the most fundamental processes in the cosmos. It is a universal phenomenon triggered by gravity, and the process by which bits of matter accumulate and coalesce with more bits of matter. It works inexorably on all scales to attract and affix smaller things to bigger things, from the tiniest dust grains to supermassive black holes. Accretion creates everything there is. Galaxies, stars, planets, and eventually us. It is the reason the universe is filled with a whole bunch of somethings instead of a whole lot of nothing. Well, you can agree with that or not agree with it, but it is interesting. The article goes on, the fact that matter tends to glom together may seem intuitive, but to scientists, accretion remains a mysterious topic filled with unanswered questions. Well, of course it does, because science, unfortunately, can't answer all the mysteries of the universe. But whether I agree with it or not, it's a kind of a cool concept for my purposes today, which is that language, which was created for us, remember? Alan always told us we're given our language, and the language has changed, and, you know, down through time. But the language and the concepts and the images that the language brings us, that has an accretion quality to it, or an accretive quality, if that's even a word. So by the time this caller is talking to Alan about a dark thing, his accretion of culture that has been given to him, his education, his indoctrination, his religion, his language, that dark thing then has become the devil or an alien. That's it. So I think one of the beauties, again, of Alan's amazing mind was that it was more or less accretion-free. He could always avoid building up the barnacles. And if he had them, I guess he cleaned that ship of mind on a regular basis. So there was freedom there in his thinking. He was not trapped by labels or fixed in time and space by one way of looking at something. And that's what language does. That's what the concepts that we get through everything, through religion, through schooling, so forth. One little thing, a recent conversation that I had with someone, they used a term which I don't like, the Judeo-Christian, and to me it's just meaningless. You know, you have a Jewish culture or a Christian culture. I don't even think there's a thing as a, you know, a real Judeo-Christian culture. So finally today I looked that up. I thought, why does that bother me so much? And it was a term that first appeared in the 19th century, and it was a missionary. He was a Christian missionary to Jews. I can't remember what his name was. But anyway, in 1821, he wrote a letter, and he used the term Judeo-Christian. And a lot of Jewish thinkers at the time did not like that word because they felt it was anti-Semitic. It implied supersessionism, which means Christianity supersedes Judaism. And evidently, and see, I knew intuitively I didn't like the term, but then I learned, you know, it's really a political term. It was used during the Cold War to show that the U.S. had a unified identity, and that unified identity was a culture that stood against communism. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's been used over and over and over, and I think now it, you know, people say it, and they don't know why they say it, because it's a cultural accretion. So someone had sent me some things about deep underground military bases, a book called The Hidden Underground Empire, and I was listening to a video by that author, and there was some interesting information there, to be sure. But then with the host, he went into what goes on in the deep underground military bases. And he got into human trafficking and organ harvesting. And then you've got blood harvesting and adrenochrome and, you know, and so forth and so on. And am I dismissing this completely out of hand? No, I'm not. But there's a whole subgenre of conspiracy theories around deep underground military bases, these dumbs. And the most provocative statements are made about things that go on there. And there's never a shred of evidence that's supplied. They never say how they know that in these deep underground military bases, human trafficking occurs or organ harvesting is done. And again, that's one of the wonders of Allen, is that he stayed away from that kind of conjecture. But I also remember, I think it might just be something in the human psyche that is interested in what we can't see, whether it's in space or whether it's deep underground. And before I even met Allen, he had sent me a disc on Underground London. Now, if you go online, you can see a lot of, you know, people going around showing you abandoned tube stations and underground bases and this and that and the other. But this one that he sent was pretty cool. I didn't find it online. And this was back before it became a cottage industry churning out these kinds of videos. And he also told me that there in near where we lived, he even pointed out a kind of a marker that he knew was a marker to an entrance to an underground base in our area. And there was a lot going on underground. In Sudbury, there is a lab called Snow Lab. So this is, you know, right over next to where we lived. It's a Canadian underground science laboratory specializing in neutrino and dark matter physics, located 2 kilometers below the surface in Vale's Creighton Nickel Mine near Sudbury, Ontario. It's an expansion of the existing facilities constructed from the original Sudbury Neutrino Observatory. It's the world's deepest operational clean room facility. So I was reminded of Allen's interest in the underground. And I learned about something that I didn't know, he never told me about. But today I was digging around and I found that in North Bay, and this was probably, don't know, a couple hours north of where we were. The Whole Truth, Five Facts About North Bay's Cold War Era Bunker. For over 40 years, one of North America's most important military facilities was 200 meters below the Canadian Shield. And it gives you this whole complex and, you know, what they might want to do with it. And it was meant to support how many people for how long in the event of such and such. And so when I was thinking about all of this and about worst case scenarios and what's going to happen, you know, this guy who was writing about the Dumbs, the hidden underground empire, was positing a world in which the temperature just kept rising and rising. And he said, you know, the polar ice caps are melting and so forth, whereas other theories say we're going into freezing, a little mini ice age. But we get a sense that something wicked this way comes. And part of the reason we get that sense is because it's shoved down our throats all the time. And another thing that I learned about when I was with Alan, we sort of learned about together, is the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, a secure backup facility for the world's crop diversity on the Norwegian island of Spitsbergen in the remote Arctic Svalbard archipelago. The seed vault provides long-term storage of duplicates of seeds conserved in gene banks around the world. This provides security of the world's food supply against the loss of seeds in gene banks due to mismanagement, accident, equipment failures, funding cuts, war, sabotage, disease, and natural disasters. And then I remembered when I was a child, my parents took us to something called Underground Atlanta, and that was a shopping and entertainment district in downtown Atlanta, Georgia. But it had been built on what was constructed in that city's post-Civil War reconstruction. So there was a whole world down there. There was a railroad. There were hotels and banks and law offices and saloons. All of this had been built underground. Some of it was destroyed by fire in the 1930s, but eventually, like I said, sometime back in the late 60s or so, they redid it, and I went there. So, and it was cool. I thought, oh, this is a really neat thing. So there is something that in us that responds to, is it safe? Do we just have some idea that it's safe there? And it's also hidden. I mean, think about, you know, just this is from, was it today or yesterday? Yeah, yes, the 13th of July. How Hamas is fighting in Gaza. Tunnels, traps, and ambushes. Hamas overwhelmed Israel's border in October with a coordinated, large-scale maneuver before committing atrocities. Now it acts as a guerrilla force, its fighters often disguised as civilians. And it's scary, right? They hide under residential neighborhoods, storing their weapons in miles of tunnels and in houses, mosques, sofas, even a child's bedroom, blurring the boundary between civilians and combatants. So they emerge from underground. Some of the scariest horror movies I've ever seen are, you know, creatures that live in, you know, abandoned World War II underground bunkers. You know, it's a fascinating thing. So I went back to Alan's books and I read the sections there in question that the caller had called in about. And sure enough, in book 2, on page 60, talking about Desdemona, and I, you know, Alan spells it, of course, Desdemon, a character in Shakespeare's play, Othello, is a woman who takes all of the blame for her husband's misfortunes. The same story down through the ages, long before the Hebrew version, lets you know that something has an agenda and women are not included in the final curtain. It should be obvious by now that eons of knowledge have gone into the formulation of our language, and that no human high priest of the mysteries could create the great deception that fools the whole world, including those elect who are promoting the change. Those who genuinely think they are protecting the system are shielding the deviant creation. C as in cell, cave equals save, having new bodies, neither male nor female. And then he goes on, as that writer points out, on page 84 of the third volume, Sparta and the fall, and Alan writes, it's the reason for dwelling on Sparta is because it is perhaps one of the most clear examples of how countries fall one by one to tried and proven methods of subversion by a determined group of men of secrecy, a special brotherhood with a cunning and totally ruthless something at the top. Something with almost incredible intellect and knowledge of human behavior. Something which plans the future many centuries in advance. That which it calls progress. Nothing more than a business plan for the entire world. There have been many Spartas down through the ages, with ever increasing mass slaughter of peoples as this dark thing gets closer and closer to its goal. So I feel that I'm kind of running out of time, but I just wanted to reiterate that I like that Alan doesn't build on the barnacle. He's trying to free us so that we can think of it in our own way and see it in our own way. And I myself, even though I spent quite a bit of time underground today, most of my time and most of my thinking was in outer space. So when Alan was talking with the caller about the UFO agenda, you know, as an agenda given to us, you know, the Hollywood agenda, I was thinking about the Fermi paradox, the Italian who asked, "Where are the aliens?" And the paradox is something like, given that our solar system is pretty young compared to the rest of the universe, about 4.5 billion years old, say compared to nearly 14 billion years old, then interstellar travel might be easy enough to achieve. And Earth should have been visited by aliens already. So where are the aliens? And then I was thinking about all of the low Earth orbit satellites and Starlink. And when you get in to looking at scalar weaponry and scalar technology, you're probably going to eventually bump into Nikola Tesla. And now who's Tesla? Elon Musk. Ooh, where does he want to take us? Mars. Oh, hey. You know, it's such a orchestrated agenda. Everything is so carefully thought out. The only thing, nothing is really left to chance, I don't think. And I think that there is a part of those who are close enough to the top so that they can put their finger up to sniff the wind, and they know, something wicked this way comes. And somehow they're stinking rich, but they're not really in on it. And so what do? Oh, underground bunkers, right? And I remember a couple of years ago, I had learned about one of those guys they call a public intellectual. And he had written a book called Survival of the Richest, Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires. This article is from The Nation, February of this year. Why billionaires are obsessed with the apocalypse. In Survival of the Richest, Douglas Rushkoff gets to the bottom of the tech oligarchy's fixation on protecting themselves from the end times. At the opening of Survival of the Richest, Douglas Rushkoff is driven hours into the desert to a luxurious, secluded compound where he meets a small group of billionaires with heavy instruments in the tech sector. The men sit him down and, after a few preliminaries about crypto, AR, and VR, proceed to ask him which remote location would be the best place to build their doomsday shelters, New Zealand or Alaska. And if they hired armed guards to protect these compounds, how could they ensure their loyalty? Would you, for example, withhold food from them or make them wear disciplinary collars? And most important, how could they insulate themselves from the people who would inevitably seek out refuge? What these men were preparing themselves for was an unspecified cataclysm that they referred to simply as the event. A self-professed humanist and Marxist media theorist, Rushkoff has long been a dissenting voice against the norms and mores of Silicon Valley. Blah, 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 blah. You can read that for yourself if you are interested. But that is interesting to me. You see, because on the following page there, after Alan writes about that dark something, that ruthless something that's getting closer and closer, he writes, "The system has been here from the beginning of civilization. Civilization defined as a relatively high level of cultural and technological development. More correctly, it is a predetermined plan where natural human organization was subverted by the introduction of minority-controlled money with minority-controlled trading and commerce. As more and more ancient civilizations are unearthed, each predating the other, we see the same sophistication of trade with clay bills of credit, debt, interest, receipt for silver, etc., coexisting with what would seem to be tribes who are living in a true communal sense. Ancient writings refer to previous ages where man reached high levels of civilization only to be destroyed by cataclysms, although in the records of India, Greece, Armenia, and others, the elite of each survived by living underground and within mountains. The elite of each survived by living underground and within mountains. Alan gave a lot of clues, and he also left a few things for us to figure out for ourselves with our own imagination, our own thinking, and our own thought journeys, if you will. And the thought journey that I had today, which I've run out of time and I can't really take you on it, but I'll give you the broad strokes. They are: it's true enough. Alan thought that Albert Einstein was a fraud, someone who, when pressed in a group of people, couldn't really talk one-on-one in an intelligible way about physics. He could talk about Zionism. And he has given us theories, the theory of general relativity and the theory of special relativity and so forth. And now we've got quantum mechanics that at least allows certain people at higher levels of research, but I think low level still, to move in a direction that they're obviously not using Einstein's, they're not confined to Einstein's theory of relativity, his physics. However, what he brought it in for the 20th century now is being taken into the quantum world with quantum computers and AI and autonomous weaponry that is in danger of directed energy weaponry. And so we have this whole battlefield that's fought without humans now. But I stumbled on something. We know that the discern faster than light. Oh, that was an error. So somebody said back in 2011 that they had an experiment, and it showed, yes, neutrinos appear to travel faster than light. And this was a cause for great excitement. But then they said, oh, no, this error in calculation, and this, wasn't synced up properly, and then we found that, and so there can be no deviation. Nothing travels faster than light. But I stumbled upon an article from back in 2014, a decade ago, and I don't know where it's gone, but I loved it. Physicists suggest speed of light might be slower than thought. Physicist James Franson of the University of Maryland, Baltimore, has captured the attention of the physics community by posting an article to the peer-reviewed New Journal of Physics in which he claims to have found evidence that suggests the speed of light, as described by the theory of general relativity, is actually slower than has been thought. Now, this is based on something that happened back in the 80s. I don't know the whole story here. The speed of light. Astronomers saw a supernova arriving 7.7 hours after the neutrinos from the same event. They ignored that evidence. But now one physicist says the speed of light must be slower than Einstein predicted. And he's developed a theory that explains why. So we'll see. But the thing that made me laugh when I read that was the headline. Physicists suggest speed of light might be slower than thought. Just hear that way. What did Einstein give us? A space-time continuum. I got another email because, like I said, I really enjoy the emails, and this is something that somebody was musing about time. Time as we know it does not exist. Linear time especially is a mental construct. Time was invented as a measuring tool to study observable cycles and events. This invention is attributed to the Babylonian priesthood who devised the measuring tool to study cosmic events, a figurative measuring tape, a tool. The concept of time was subsequently used as an organizational and managerial tool for populations. Time remained somewhat nebulous for the general populations of humankind for thousands of years following its invention, mostly an organizational tool and for worship. The vast majority of humans still using observable cycles as a guide for daily life and future planning. Think agrarian paradigm, dominating for thousands of years, the sun, the moon, the stars, observable cycles, natural human. The Industrial Revolution marks the point at which the concept of time begins to dominate humankind. It is at this point as well that money and time are intimately married in their dominance of human thought. The wage slave is invented. Today, people are protesting in the streets for a higher minimum wage, the entire premise based on value per hour. Value per hour. The human reduced to groveling for higher hourly value while completely unaware of their hoodwink. This is the insanity. We've adopted their perversion and put time on the altar. We now forever slave against a perceived tick-tock within our own minds, at once driving us like a mule while also convincing us of our own insignificance. We've confused a measuring tool. How long should I bake the cake in the oven? For a truth. And now live fully within a false paradigm. We have fully adopted time and now can viscerally feel it escaping us. Consider the magnitude of this fact. The invention of linear time was essential for their false narratives to be accepted, most importantly, to convince us of material science and the evolutionary model of humankind. On their timeline and in our minds, we are meaningless and insignificant. And he goes on to talk about the timepiece, the status symbol of the timepiece, etc. But I liked that because, again, that title that grabbed my attention, physicists suggest speed of light might be slower than thought. When I first saw that, I thought, well, yes, of course, thoughts are faster than the speed of light. And I admit, I always had a problem when I was watching sci-fi with Alan and there was time travel. The whole causality thing. Huh? What? I would ask and we'd have these conversations. But what if Einstein got it wrong? Obviously, those at the top, or better question is, what if Einstein was only put there to keep us in a very limited space-time continuum as they ground down what was left of our imagination, what was left of our innate sense of our sacred connection to the great all, to our sense of our own captains of our barnacle-less ships, barnacle-less ships. All right, it's 1 o'clock in the morning and I am so late sitting down because I had to spend a couple of hours on the assassination attempt of Donald Trump. And all of the holes in this, obviously, something is rotten in the state of Denmark event. And you've all, by now, you all know all about it. And I'll just leave you to that yourselves and wish you a very good week. Bye-bye.
There's a cold silence that we don't dare speak. There's a wall between us and a river so deep. We keep pretending that there's nothing wrong.
I'm Alan Watts, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix. It's October the 24th, 2007, and it's been quite the busy week for me. It's also been a very rainy week up here in Canada. It's about the second or third week of rain. And I think we're all shrinking up here and getting smaller by the day. For those newcomers, please look into cuttingthroughthematrix.com. We can download lots of the histories of how we got to where we are today, where we're going, and the big foundations and organizations behind it all. It's a planned society. And as I say, it's always busy up here. There's always something going on. And last Sunday, I was standing in the laundromat, watching the dryer going round, watching my own version of As the World Turns at 25 cents per 5 minutes view, and thinking about the control freaks that run our society, and how cleverly, scientifically, in fact, we've all been conditioned from birth, as our parents were too, to think that we're just progressing steadily along some strange course that only God himself would know. And nothing is further from the truth, because when you hit the big, thick old books, the old books that used to gather dust on library shelves, and were always ignored by the general public, you find the meetings and the minutes of the meetings of international foundations discussing the kind of society and the kind of world they hope to bring into being, and it's all pretty well here. What's happening today with the world is the U.S. takes the lead, as it was designed, in fact, to do. It takes the lead as the policeman of the world, forcing the last few countries into the same system. All of this was written about a long time ago, and you can find some of it as far back as the 1700s. In fact, read the Founding Fathers' comments on the federation of the world and the hope that the United States federation would be the nucleus of it. Franklin himself said he saw a world federation eventually that would be run by 12 wise men, because he was a Mason and a Kabbalist. They've gone on since then because they've acquired the big foundations, came into being through all means that they possibly could. And you can go as far back as the Knights Templars, for instance, the first banking establishment, international banking establishment, really, that the world has seen, that used paper notes in lieu of actual gold at that time, gold and silver. And you get a check from them and travel to the Middle East and cash it in one of their temples over there. Tremendous bankers. And they even used a giant chessboard for their debts and their credits. That's how they worked it out. That's where the word check, your check that you cash, comes from. I'll be back with more after the following messages. To continue, as I was talking about the Knights Templars and the tremendous international banking system that they'd set up with all their temples across the Middle East, right, all the way back through Europe and even into England, and how they did their debts and their debits and their credits on a huge chessboard, outside chessboard, with big poles that they'd move these pieces around on. And that's how they worked out what they'd given out and loans and what they were due back. And even today, the head of the British Treasury is called the Chancellor of the Exchequer, because it was on the like a checkerboard. And that's where the word check comes from. They dished out paper money, which you could cash in on the other end of their, and get it from their temple, come out with gold, etc., in any country. And that was the beginning of it. They also had a form of tax-free exemption in all their profits from the Vatican. And they went their own way with that. But it didn't end there. Even when old de Molay, or Jake the Mole, as they say, went undercover or was killed because the boys with the treasury escaped. You had a huge flotilla of ships, and a lot of them ended up in Argyllshire in Scotland, where their graves can still be seen today. And they were also into the New World long before Columbus came along, because at Oak Island, they've done the research there and they've found the Templar insignias on various stones that were set up in a Templar fashion again on a particular island, plus they had a treasure buried there. But Queen Elizabeth the First Court is where they came out more openly, calling themselves Rosicrucians. They do have different branches. The branches are not in opposition to each other, although sometimes they appear to be. They're actually all specialized branches with their own specialized tasks. But the Rosicrucians that initially came out in Queen Elizabeth I's court and who were her advisors were also, not only that, they were also pirates. And their idea was to take as much wealth as they could into their coffers, become extremely wealthy. And as later on, Albert Pike eventually said, we shall become the masters over the masters of the world. Pike also authorized the beginning of the International Revolutionary Society that became the Communist Party. And he trained Mazzini, went over to Italy and started the revolution there. Mazzini handed it over and Lenin took over and called it the Bolshevik Party. So revolution was one of their main keys, but also gathering the wealth to back it all up was the other part. And this wasn't for the working people or anything like that. As I say, they run both sides of everything. It's to garnish wealth, to get power, and to become specialists over the public. The public are called the profane, those who are in the darkness. They don't know. That's what it means. But they also see themselves having the right to profit from the herd, another term they use, because that's the function of a herd, and we're also sheep. They are the shepherds. Now, the trick of the shepherd is to convince the sheep that the interests of the shepherd and the sheep both are in the same direction. That's the first con. Once the sheep accept it, they go along through their lives until they're slaughtered and eaten, and their wool taken to make the clothes for the good old shepherd. or the wolf, as I prefer to call them. So that's what we've been watching our whole lives. We've been living through this system as they garnish money. They have no problem in coming out in the open once in a while with their big scandals, and as they loot the general public. They do it through bank failures, bank collapses, depressions, and all that kind of thing. And they've done it quite a few times in history, even recent history, and I'm sure they have another one lined up, especially with the US dollar down the road. But it's not only that. You see, they see themselves as having the right to scientifically train us, and they set up and they fund the big scientific institutions. Many of the top members of these institutions are also the high masons themselves. And just to read a little bit of this report that came out of Britain, is to show you how far the control freaks are going. And this is straight out of George Orwell's 1984. If you remember, Orwell himself started off his book with him in his room, and he has to jump up in front of the television camera and the big television screen and start exercising in front of this image. You can see him, because the physical fitness and keeping fit and all this kind of stuff is part of the ultimate training. This is from the Independent newspaper, and it says here, unveiled radical prescription for a health crisis. Obesity, alcohol abuse, smoking. Britain is amongst the most unhealthy countries in Europe. Now a pioneer in the National Health Service advisor is proposing a revolutionary cure for our ills. Jeremy Lawrence, health editor, 23rd of October, 2007. A radical plan is being unveiled to persuade people to stop smoking, take more exercise, and change their diets, as proposed last night by a leading government advisor. As new figures were published yesterday showing that England tops the European League as the fattest nation in the EU, Professor Julian Legrand, chair of Health England and a former senior Downing Street aide to Tony Blair, said a completely fresh approach was required by government to reverse the epidemic of obesity and tackle similar ills caused by excess consumption. In a speech to the Royal Statistical Society, they even had a Department of Statistics in Orwell's 1984. Professor Legrand said, instead of requiring people to make healthy choices by giving up smoking, taking exercise, etc., policies should be framed so the healthy option is automatic, in other words, mandatory, and people have to choose deliberately to depart from it. Now, it is what he's suggesting here. He wants a smoking permit, which smokers would have to produce when buying cigarettes, and an exercise hour to be provided by all large companies for their employees, and a ban on salt and processed food. The idea is dubbed libertarian paternalism, reverses the traditional government approach that requires individuals to opt into healthy schemes. Instead, they would have to opt out to make the unhealthy choice by buying a smoking permit, choosing not to participate in the exercise hour, or adding salt at the table. By preserving individual choice, the approach could be defended against charges of a nanny state, he said. Some people say this is paternalism squared. I like that. Paternalism squared is a Mason tongue. But at a fundamental level again, you're not being made to do anything. If it's not like banning something, it's not prohibition. It's a softer form of paternalism. So it's not totalitarianism, it's paternalism. And this goes on and on to go through all the justifications as to why they should do this. Now, those who don't smoke miss the whole point of this, because the old saying is, they came for the socialist and I wasn't a socialist, so they left me alone. Then they came for this other one, and all the way down until they came for the Gypsies, the Jews, and so on, and the Slavs. But I wasn't one, but they grabbed me anyway at the end, because there's no one left to stand for me. Well, it's the same old thing here. This is the beginning of the movement to control everything in your life, because now they want to bring everyone in annually, this is adults too, and weigh you and keep records on you. That's what it's all about, totalitarianism. You are property, because they're the shepherds, you see, and you're the sheep. And they always take care of their animals. Now, I think we have Kirk in California. Are you there, Kirk? Hello? Kirk in California? Nope. Okay, Andrew in British Columbia? nobody's there. Well, I'll continue with this particular piece I've been reading here. It's on to say here, permits for smoking could be issued annually and the signatures of a doctor might even be needed. This would require individuals to opt in each year to being a smoker rather than opting out by choosing to give up. Sellers of tobacco from supermarkets to tobacconists would have to see the permit before any sale. To get a permit would involve filling out a form and supplying a photograph as well as paying the required fee. Permits would only be issued to those over 18 and evidence of age would have to be provided. The money raised for the permits would go to the National Health Service. Oh, sure it will. Time for employees to take exercise during the working day, ban on salt and processed food, restrictions on the sale of alcohol, and an extension of the free fruit scheme for children are also among ideas that deserve investigation, he added. Betty McBride, public affairs manager of the British Heart Foundation, said, "This sounds like Nanny as Major General. We would have a problem with the smoking permit because it might suggest smoking was all right once you had the permit." It's amazing how control freaks think, though, isn't it? But overall, this is exactly the kind of thinking we need to be doing, asking tough questions and turning things on their head. Well, they certainly would, wouldn't they? Because they'll also eventually give you a permit for food, you see. And if they claim you're obese, you'll have to get a special permit if you want anything with a little fat in it. You know, something tasty. Now, where is all this coming from? Well, the war on smoking, you see, first came from the United Nations. They were the ones who backed it. And they now have a war on obesity that also comes from the United Nations. The United Nations is their big nanny, and they have a big stick as well for other and different purposes. But at the moment, they're being the nanny in the socialized countries. And it's only a matter of time before this same mandate is pushed in Canada and everywhere else on the world. Now, they never go after the big companies. But now, for 40 years, they've been pushing nothing but ads for the big fast food companies that put all that junk in their food. There's very little nourishment, really. That's why people are obese. Their body craves vitamins, minerals, and proteins. And that big burger there looks like a burger. Kind of smells like one, but it's not really a burger. It's had all of its nutrients removed from it. And people are really hungry, you see, and that's why they eat all that. What they fill them full of is that monosodium glutamate. And that is the stuff that really makes you think you have a taste there. It's a chemical that goes right into your tongue, goes deeper than any natural food, and stimulates it and makes you think you've actually had got some tasty food there. Now, there's no bans against the use of that, apparently. But the big corporations can get away with pretty well anything they want. But we'll see if Kirk in California is still there. Are you there, Kirk? Hello? Are you there,
Alan,
Kirk?
Alan, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I tried to get through earlier, but I guess there was a problem with the phone line. How are you doing this evening?
I'm surviving just, yeah.
Oh, well, I have a question. Have you ever heard of the Knights Hospitaller or Hospitaller of St. John of Jerusalem?
Yeah. Yeah.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I could barely hear you.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever heard of that organization?
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah.
Sure. Could you tell me a little bit about them? I mean, as far as, like, are they like a Masonic organization? Are they...
Yeah, all these organizations. See, knight in itself is Masonic, really.
Yeah.
Anything to do with the word knight in it becomes Masonic. And they're builders of society. And the Hospitallers went off, and they had different places even. I think they had Malta eventually and became Knights of Malta. And,
right.
And you find different ones joining it all the time. Big players that come out and lead the public often get to be Knights of Malta. It's supposedly mainly a Catholic organization, however, for higher types of Masons. There's also a lower order for Catholics as well, but the Knights of Columbus. But the Knights of Malta are generally much, much wealthier, a different category. You'll find that there's a class system in Masonry, as there is within everything else, and all these boys play the same game at the top.
The reason I asked, I was watching a DVD the other day, and it was by a guy by the name of Dr. Leonard Horowitz.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I was listening to some of the things he said, and, you know, there was a lot of truth in what he was talking about. He was talking about different pandemics, and then he was going into the Committee of 300 and various different things. So I was listening to him. And then after I watched the DVD, I started looking into him, as I do anyone, including you as well.
Yeah.
And just to, you know, to verify information, to see who I'm listening to and what they're all about. Yeah. And I noticed that he got knighted by this group.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so I sent him an email and asked him about it, and, of course, he got a little nasty with it. I mean, kind of snippy about it, and he was kind of, you know, to the effect of, you know, well, you know, there's good people in every organization and things like that. And I was kind of like going, this seems a little odd.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know. But, I mean, the thing is, too, you've got to be careful with all the leaders we put out into society. I keep telling people that, I mean, even if I go on shows, too, it doesn't mean I necessarily go along with the hosts. And, you know, you can get led a merry dance as you're trying to find truth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of religion mixed up with it, you'll find. There's a lot of belief systems of all kinds. You'll find that there's deliberate shills put in there, too. And you'll find that there are those that come out of nowhere and become very popular, had they're heavily backed financially, and books are just churned out faster than I can visit the washroom, which is impossible, but that's what happens.
Right.
And and then they go and get knighted, you know.
Yeah, that's what I know. So I thought it was very odd. That's why I kind of was looking into him, and I was going, his information seemed pretty good. But once I saw that, it definitely kind of turned me off to the whole scenario. Once you start associating with these groups, then you have to question what his intentions really are at some point, or whoever it might be.
Well, the intentions for all authors are right there. If you can validate what they say, that's one thing. But when they start coming into bringing the Bible back in, and to just to get good vibrations to cure illnesses, and then you got to start thinking for yourself.
Oh, and I definitely do, and that's why when I first started watching his things, I was kind of, you know, as any information that I'm seeking out there, I look as many different places as I can. Like, I've been reading many of the books that you have recommended. They're very hard to find, a lot of them, for whatever reason that might be, but the ones that I did manage to get a hold of, Tragedy and Hope and Anglo-American Establishment, the Impact of Science on Society,
yeah,
as well as a few others, I mean, those have really helped me understand, especially like when you listen to Huxley give his speech, the one in 62 you have on your site. I mean, that is pretty, pretty telling. And I'm just really amazed how they just come out and just tell you.
Yeah, and you also find another thing to be careful and watch for. If they come out with all of the problems that we have, terrify the life out of you, and then promote an organization that belongs to the United Nations to take over a whole department of your life, then that's another little clue.
Right, because it kind of compartmentalizes you in a way.
Well, the United Nations is just going to be one even further government, so remote that none of us can get in touch with. And it's not going to be democratic, because the United Nations is not a democratic institution.
Yeah, they're not really interested in anything we have to say.
They have none, no interest whatsoever.
Right.
You know,
okay, well, I just wanted to ask you that question, and that was kind of what I was thinking anyway. But
yes,
I was just kind of curious to lean on your expertise as well. And oh, one other thing real quick. I heard you mention on one of your blurbs, I mean, or it may have been on the show, that you were having a little bit of trouble with your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't know if you would like a set of glasses donated or anything.
But depending what kind they were, you know, if they were any good.
Yeah, well, I would not send you junk. Can I leave my number with a fellow, and then whenever
sure
you have an opportunity, call me back, and then we can talk a little bit?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
Okie doke.
Well, thank you, Alex.
Bye now. Now, Andrew from BC is on the line. Are you still there, Andrew? Hello? Hello, is Andrew there?
This is not Andrew.
Okay, who are you?
This is Jake from Texas.
Okay, have you got a question?
Well, I would like to talk about...
Hold on, and we'll be back after the break. I hear the music vaguely.
Okay, I'll hang on.
Okay. And but a man on the line there, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Yeah, continue, please.
Well, I would like to ask about alien encounters.
Yeah.
And, well, I hear you chuckle there, but I have had an alien encounter, and I am not, I can't quite say if it's been something that was manufactured by the powers that be or the U.S. government or
yeah, well,
whatever.
Yeah, why would you call it an alien encounter until you're sure?
Well, you know, it's the classic thing with the grays and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, if it hadn't been for the fact that my mother encountered, was with me in the same thing, I would not, and there was also other physical things, like the fact that when I woke up in the morning, I had different clothes on than when I went to sleep.
Yeah.
And the fact that my shotgun had a round in the chamber, which I don't usually keep one in there when I go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I remember was racking my shotgun before this happened. I know something happened.
Mm-hmm. But, well, something happened, but the thing is,
but I have a hard time thinking that it was really aliens because I've had other things with the government before.
Yeah. And you know, some of these experiments with governments, and they have done these kind of things, you know, when people are put under deep narcosis as opposed to hypnosis. Under hypnosis, the hypnotist can suggest anything into anyone. And we've all had massive doses of the greys and all this stuff that started a whole spree of people thinking they were abducted, and that was from Whitley Strieber's book, which turned into a massive movie very quickly, and that's what started the whole thing off of abductions. However, under narcosis therapy,
but under
narcosis therapy, what you find, what you'll find is that people actually see people in laboratory coats around them, and not little aliens, and that's what's very interesting.
Well, I don't have any memory of that particularly, but I do have a memory of seeing small figures out on the front lawn there, so to speak.
Yeah.
And my mother also has a history of encounters with UFOs, or it could have been military aircraft for all I know.
Yeah. And we've had them for a long time.
When she was a child and she was living in Roswell, and my grandfather was working on the base in Roswell.
Yeah. Yeah, and we know now that all the governments, Britain too, have bases. And Roswell initially started off, I don't know if you know that, with the American Rocket Institute. That's where it began.
Oh, yes. I know that.
It's got an involvement with experimental aircraft. Bill Cooper did a fantastic video on Area 51. He took a group of his listeners down there. They photographed these things coming out of underground hangars. This is a military base. They're made here. And the greatest cover they ever had was to say, oh, it must be from Mars. And everyone suddenly looks at the stars. I never think of looking underground where they actually were being built.
Well, my grandfather, I was born in Albuquerque, and my grandfather worked at the Air Force base there.
Yeah.
And he used to, when I was a small child, he'd take me to the base and show me around, and I saw a few things that I knew were obviously government projects, but you would think of them as UFOs or something like that.
Yes, they've got amazing technology at a high level that's always kept quiet from the public. And we saw that during even the Cold War. They gave disinformation to the public because it helped the public talk all the time. And they had all this high-tech equipment, the scalar weaponry. They have little saucer-shaped things that can whiz across the sky. I've seen them. I've seen them outside the Lossiemouth Air Force Base in Britain. And these things can stop on a dime. There's no slowing down. They suddenly stop. And this technology is here. It's not from aliens, though.
Well, I've also seen plenty of things that I'm not sure whether, you know, if they're man-made or what the heck they are. But
well, the thing is, you've got to remember, there's been a massive campaign.
No idea.
to get the public, number one, to believe in flying saucers.
Right.
And John Dewey was the first character that came out and said at a national, international meeting, if we can convince the public that they're being attacked from outer space, we can bring the whole world together as one and bring in their world government system. Here's a quote right from Lester B. Pearson, who was the head of the UN at one time, and eventually he was the Prime Minister of Canada. He says, perhaps there is a hopeful possibility here in the conquest of outer space. Interplanetary activity may well give us planetary peace. Once we discover Martian spaceships hovering over the Earth's airspace, we will all come together. How dare they threaten us like that, we shall shout, as one at a really United Nations. That was said in October the 7th, 1957.
Oh, I see.
And then out come all the movies, sci-fi, very intriguing stuff. And they even had the day the Earth stood still. The whole agenda was a spaceman came down with his robot and convinced the world they better unite under the United Nations or the world would be destroyed. And then, of course, we had all the sightings that started heavily publicized.
So that's why they're not afraid to show their technology openly.
Yeah, the public now are convinced they come from outer space.
Yeah. I understand.
And
and I have one more observation. I live here in Texas. This year we've had record rainfall. Last year we had record drought.
Mm-hmm.
Now this may be coincidental, but near where I live, there were some trailers that were hooked into the gas supply so that they would have power.
Mm-hmm.
And the name on them was Rain for Rent.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Those appeared right before that the rain started. They disappeared in the night,
yeah.
Overnight,
mm-hmm.
Right after the rain stopped.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, I know that.
I've looked up that name on the internet. It's supposedly a reputable company that rents trailers for things transporting whatever sort of liquids you want or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was very interesting. There's been major
ads in newspapers worldwide from Russia, for instance. Offering to create the kind of weather that you want, rain, whatever you need, for a certain price. This is the old technology. It's been used for ages, and we have our own versions of it here in the Americas, and they're using it. That's how they wiped out the farmers out west in Canada. They gave them about 4 years of drought, and then they flooded them out the following year. And you'll find always in the standing rain area, standing wave area, you have a tremendous heat build up for maybe 100-odd miles or more, a couple hundred miles, then you have rain all around the perimeter of it. So that's typical. They're using the stuff right now. It's made for weather warfare. The warfare is on the public to change our ways.
Well, the other reason I thought of that was they just put in the fiber optic lines for, quote, the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from working on the HARP type transmitters at the place that made the HARP transmitters here in Dallas that those are controlled fiber optically from the place. And I was like, fiber optics, trailers that say rain,
mm-hmm.
It appears and disappears in the night. It can't be a coincidence. And I also know that you could stick one of those transmitters into one of those containers.
Sure.
And I didn't see any antennas anywhere, but that doesn't mean that they haven't concealed.
Yeah, as I say, you'll find a lot of dirty tricks going on with government agencies. They have hundreds of agencies going around doing odd kinds of things all over the place under names you'd never suspect generally. But the CIA has run most high-tech companies in the U.S., set them up and run it, and still do, than any other country. So I'm not surprised at all. I've also seen the military do it here in Canada, with bringing in big trailers and put them in a sort of square shape altogether, and they have hundreds of small satellites on them all pointing in the same direction. Hundreds of them. So they have mobile units as well, for sure. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, thanks for calling
in. Okay, thank you very much. Bye.
Yeah, so that's what we live in today, as I say. Now, the alien thing, is it was well put out, because science fiction was promoted in the 1800s by a fund from the Rothschild Foundation in England. It eventually became the Futurist Society, where they bring in budding authors. And if you play the game right and you say, yes, 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 sir, then they'll give you a contract and tell you what to write. And that's called predictive programming. And just like Bertrand Russell said, shortly the public will be able to be convinced of anything with enough propaganda. Well, it's happened, and most propaganda is through stories that we love. They're very interesting and fascinating. They grab our imaginations, and before you know it, everybody's seeing flying saucers, and they think they're seeing aliens all over the place. A study that they did on people who were supposedly abducted, they did a study on 200 of them in the U.S., and they did this in Britain too, and a study with people who had never claimed to be abducted, and under hypnosis, pretty well all of them claimed to be abducted, even the ones who had no memory of it at all. And what they found out was they'd all read the same newspapers, they'd read the same stories. They'd started off with Barney and Betty Hill. It was in media worldwide, and all the other stories followed up until it was in their subconscious. So that's how it's done. It's through programmers, through repetition. So even our subconscious becomes infected with the idea. And when you're asked the right questions, you'll claim that you're abducted too. You know the formulas, you know what the other one said, and you'll say it happened to you. These are old techniques again. But it's a great cover, because the whole idea was to divert the public's knowledge that governments or governmental agencies were so far ahead scientifically that they'd never catch on. It had to be from out there somewhere. And it's worked very, very, very well indeed. The sciences are always classed in three different levels. From professorship down is the lowest level of science. Higher than the professors, you find that they have high-tech equipment, portable equipment that the CIA use. Nick Bigage demonstrated that on the CBC Canada years ago on Wendy Meslier, where you could put thoughts into a person's head from a distance. They'd hear it in the middle of their head. And this was done by something you'd put into your pocket, like a little TV remote. Obviously solid circuitry, solid state technology, long before the public even heard of transistorized, the bigger stuff. This was already miniaturized in solid state, had to be. And it was all used in the 1950s by, as he said, the CIA. Everything that he showed there was obsolete. And yet nothing was said in major universities about this kind of technology right up until recently. The higher than them, of course, you have special units that were set up during the Cold War, which really have an authority or a right to kill, if need be, and they travel around in little white vans around our countries. And these are like the A-teams. The A-team is actually based on certain characters who were given this kind of authority under the direction of the Pentagon. Now, Andrew from Vancouver, are you there? Hello, Andrew. Now, I guess he's off the line. But we'll try and see if he can fit in the last few minutes. But, yeah, so they've had these A-team-type characters going around, funded by the Pentagon, given a clearance higher than CIA, that way they couldn't be touched no matter what they did internally or externally, and they were given all these kind of high-tech equipment that the public would never, ever guess, because it was unknown to them. It was outside of her ken, as they say. No one would ever have guessed they had it. They had all the voice-to-skull technologies. They could make you see things, hear things, give you hallucinations, and you go and talk about it, and you could be locked up. Hello? Are you there, Andrew? No.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question about the people way up at the top of the pyramid.
Uh-huh.
So I'm reading your book, and in Book 2, mm-hmm. there's a quote. Can I give it?
Yeah.
Okay, so Book 2, page 60, it says, "No human, accent on human, high priest of the mysteries could create the great deception that fools the whole world."
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's pretty dramatic, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I thought that was, for me, that was a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And so I went into Book 3,
mm-hmm.
and another quote from page 84.
Yep.
It says, "Countries fall one by one by subversion by a determined group of men of secrecy, a special brotherhood with a cunning and total ruthless something at the top."
Yep.
Something.
Yeah.
"Almost incredible intellect and knowledge of human behavior. Something."
Mm-hmm. Yep.
"Which plans the future many centuries in advance." And then a little bit later, you say, "This dark thing."
Mm-hmm.
And so that sounded almost like the devil or aliens or, I mean, definitely something inhuman, because you use that word a couple of pages later.
Yep.
In describing that. This
yeah, well, there's no doubt that you're talking about something that is definitely inhumane.
Okay.
There's two categories. You've got human and humaneness, and you have inhumanity.
Well, then they could just be a bunch of inbred psychopaths.
Yes, but there's no doubt they themselves do have a religion. And their religion encompasses things which are pretty well the opposite of what we think of as a normal, functioning, good, healthy society. Their ability to guide society into forms of hell on Earth
uh-huh.
are very, very real, as they've done with world wars and all the other wars they've had before. They tell incredible lies to whole nations of people without blinking.
Uh-huh.
And now psychopaths certainly can do that. But they also have a belief in themselves as a form of God. And I think that's the music. We'll be back after. Hang on, and we'll talk after the phone.
Yeah, okay.
I've got someone on the line from British Columbia. Talking about what is this thing at the top, this power, this force, this evil that seems to be running the big boys, the boys that plan wars, the ones who plan the takedown of societies, the ones who even figure out how many they'll lose in a war, like little toy soldiers, and not be affected by it because it's all just little games to them. What are these people? And what it boils down to, really, is a society of upper psychopaths, higher psychopaths, definitely inbred, for sure. And as Plato said, you can breed out or in to a society any trait at all, just like you can breed traits in or out of a dog, depending on the kind of dog you want. If you want a lap dog, then you make sure it's a very friendly dog that you breed another one with, both the same kind, and just keep breeding that quality into them. But if you want kings and queens who can rule and be ruthless at times, you want someone who's basically psychopathic. You would make sure that that little part inside that old brain box that makes you truly human and compassionate is deficient, and you breed them with another of the same kind, and you end up with lineages of them. And that's what we have today. We know that with Charles Darwin, who only married, his family only married into the Wedgwood family and then the Galtons later on. But for generations, they only bred into one other family to try to get certain traits out in the offspring, which they thought would be geniuses. And in a sense, they were geniuses along certain paths, but they were also monsters in their own right, because they had no compassion for people whatsoever. And they all end up being into eugenics, ultimately. Eugenics, the science of the class types, the ones who should be allowed to survive coming into a next stage, and the ones who would have to perish because they were too primitive. These are eugenicists, and that's what we have, this under a cloak now of bioethics committees. That's a new term for eugenics, as bioethics committees. These pseudoscientists who use science and statistics, etc., to try and justify what they want to do with humanity. They want to improve us, they say, but what they really mean is they want to kill off or cull off inferior types. And you'll find within Masonry, it's the only organization that actually accepts eugenics as being a natural thing, lesser types and better types and higher types of humanity. The profane, the collective masses who never join, never clue into all their cons and games that go on, are basically the unworthy ones, the ones that have to be wiped out. And they took that from an older religion because it comes from Hinduism that believes in the waves of theosophy, the waves that come and go through time through millions of years, and that the lesser types are always wiped out at the beginning of a new age. They're not allowed into the new age for fear that they'll bring down those who are rising, as they call it. You've heard of Earth rising. Well, this is also the elite rising, the new type of man. The great leap forward, as they keep talking about, that's what that means. It's a eugenics religious idea. So what is it at the top that they worship? Really, it's their own strange traits, traits that we can't identify with because they are so incredibly clever and inhumane, totally inhumane. And they use double speak with everything that they say to us. They say one thing but mean another. That's why we accept all the laws, etc., that come down, thinking they're rather benign until you see the real consequences of them. It's for control purposes, as they control us all along this path into the big sheep pen, where they can then rearrange society, perfect that which was left imperfect, which means us, all of us, you see, the imperfect ones, and eliminate the ones that cannot come through into a new age. That's what it's all about. So science is so close to seance, and it is interesting that they've always used mediums and so on. Even Albert Pike had his own medium. And, of course, it's a great way to justify what you're doing, whether it's a god that tells you you're on the right path, or a spirit, or whoever they claim it is. It's good to have something from beyond to justify what really is your own psychopathic nature and your psychopathic plans. From Hamish and myself in Ontario, Canada, it's good night, and may your god or your gods go with you.